Thank you, Toby. Shall we go ahead and pray? Lord God, we're grateful for your Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, who has told us, who has shown us by example and by precept how we're to live and how we're not to live. And we thank you tonight for our brother Charles from coming to us from South Africa. I pray you'll bless him as he speaks to us, and may we especially appreciate the grace that you have shown to us here in this wonderful country. And may we be convicted again of how horribly we are despising that grace that you have given to us. May we understand that. May we not forget it, we pray. We ask again for your blessing, and we thank you for everyone here. Pray these things in the name of Christ, our Savior and Lord. Amen. Okay, real quickly, speaking of the book table, it's too late for Charles' book. So I hope you got it. They're gone. There are a couple of them here. They're gone. There's one video left, DVD left, Shooting Back. It's free. On the count of three, you're allowed to go get it. One, two. Just kidding. There may be a way to get that. But we're thrilled to have Charles Van Wyk. There's a lot of ways to pronounce that, but Van Wyk, I believe, is the correct pronunciation. I've been practicing this afternoon. Charles comes to us. He's a full-time missionary and best-selling author of Shooting Back, The Right and Duty of Self-Defense. We talk about the right of self-defense. Do we talk about the duty of self-defense? Charles addresses that in his book. He writes a monthly ministry newsletter and has a feature article published by WorldNet Daily, an independent U.S. news company. Charles has served on the committees of ministries such as Frontline Fellowship, Africa Christian Action, and others. Charles is working at this point in countries in Southern Africa, including the Congo and Zimbabwe, two very difficult countries, setting up schools, helping people start businesses. And what Charles is doing in Southern Africa is trying to transform Southern Africa. He has about as much chance as those crazy pilgrims that came over in the Mayflower. We know that one day the glory of the Lord will fill the earth as the waters cover the sea. Why not get started? Charles on his way in Southern Africa. We're thrilled to have him tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Charles Van Wyk.
Good evening. It's wonderful to be here again. Thank you so much for the invitation, the committee of Mars that's having me over again. It's a wonderful time to be with like-minded people. Really enjoy my fellowship around with people that are thinking the same way and doing the same sort of work. So here's my website. If you would like a copy of the book or a DVD, you can actually click through from my website, missionaryinafrica.com. That's my sweet little family. Taken a little while back. This evening, I want to cover the issue of South Africa's slippery slope to surrender. We were in South Africa many years ago. Great, thank you. When my family and I came over to America about 6 years ago, we were staying near Washington, D.C. area, and I remember us going out and going to a park where children are playing and things, and my wife looked at this and said, "This is the way we grew up. Can you believe this?" Because now we're so crime-ridden that you're very careful about where you walk and where you go. You don't allow your children to go out into the streets when they're young, and you'll be very careful about all these things. Just to give you a quick idea, where I live, in my own house, my neighbor next door has been stabbed. 100 yards up the road, another neighbor was murdered. Cars have been stolen on both sides of our property. My sister-in-law has been attacked right outside our property. The stabber of the neighbor was caught inside my back garden by the police, and they kicked the living daylights out of the man while my kids were all standing at the lounge window watching everything. It traumatized them for a couple of years, to the extent that when we came to America, we were looking at the townhouse that we were going to stay in near Washington, D.C. in Springfield, And my oldest son, who was about 9 years old at the time, looked at this place and said, there's no way we're staying in that house, Dad. Why not? There's no burglar bars. No security gates. What are the people thinking about here? So, really interesting. But let's move on to what is happening in South Africa. Isaiah 4 verse 6. My people perish from lack of knowledge. And when South Africa went down the slippery slope, we didn't have the WhatsApps, we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have all the modern technology today. And so the way to get information out was through newsletters, which took a long time to print, and the postal system, days or weeks to get to people. They find out the information, everything moved really slowly. It was very difficult because the government controlled the media. It was illegal to open a radio station. There were no private radio stations. There weren't any private television stations. And even although you can have a pseudo-good kind of a government controlling all those things, when the bad people take over, guess what? They control it. So they use it for bad things. South Africa's National Party was under pressure from the Bush senior government and the State Department and also the international community to hand over power to the African National Congress. That was Nelson Mandela's group in South Africa. And the South African Communist Party controls that African National Congress. A friend of mine, Avios Kuela, who heads up the Black Gun Owners Association, he said to me, the African National Congress, Mandela's group, is the South African Communist Party. He said they can't call themselves that because they're going to lose international funding if they call themselves the Communist Party. But they're one and the same. And he said, I was involved with them. I'm talking from experience. I'm not an outsider that's telling you this. So here we have Nelson Mandela. The white man over there was a colonel in the KGB. And he was living in South Africa as a non-South African and dealing and dealing for the South African Communist Party on behalf of Russia. A friend of mine has just read his book. And apparently in his book he says, we were getting all this funding from Russia to overthrow the South African National Party government. He said, but we didn't know all the bad things that were going on in Russia at the time. How could we have known? 100 million people murdered since 1917, and they didn't know about that. So in retrospect, maybe we shouldn't have taken the money. So it's just the rewriting of history and not taking responsibility for anything, and that's the way things go right at the moment. So even though the human rights abuses, such as the white domination that was going on, and there was racism and apartheid as the reasons given for the overthrow or the onslaught against South Africa, we've got vast mineral resources, and that seemed to be something that the people in the Western world were really excited to get their hands on. And we've got to ask ourselves the question, if those are all the reasons that caused the onslaught and the reason for the onslaught, then why in the other countries around us, like Angola and Namibia, Zimbabwe and Mozambique, were also handed over to the communists, but none of them had apartheid. None of them had a policy of apartheid at all. So why were they handed over? Then we've got to ask ourselves, well, if we were being nailed in South Africa, what about all the tens of millions of people that were murdered in the Soviet Union and in China? They still had their positions in the United Nations. Nobody criticized them. They didn't have any problems. They were still voting. But yet they nailed a little small country at the bottom of Southern Africa. So there are the countries around us. You can see Angola, Zambia, Namibia, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, all handed over to the communists through pressure from the international community. The upheaval in South Africa wasn't only racial. It was also ideological. It was spiritual. It was a battle between communism and capitalism, between socialism and the free market, between the Antichrist and a Christian heritage and a culture. In the early days, when South Africa was busy being set up already, we had two great Christian nations, republics, that were formed called the Free State and the Transvaal Republic, or the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek, South African Republic. Two Christian nations, really interesting setup there. Paul Kruger was the president of the Transvaal Republic, and one of the laws stated that every male had to, by law, own a firearm. Interesting in that time. international domination of South Africa versus the South Africa remaining as a sovereign nation. And so a lot of pressure on there. Around about this time, we had all the issues going on in China. China was backing the communists in South Africa. Russia was backing them. And then we also had the State Department of America also backing the bad guys. The African National Congress and this mother organization, the Communist Party, they took over South Africa by following a really interesting strategy. And here's how they did it. There was a blockade by the Marxist states north of us, so we couldn't move around and do business around Africa. They're being armed by the Soviet Union. Dr. Peter Hammond, who's spoken here before, wrote a Mozambique report, which was discussed, I think, in the British Parliament and in Congress here. He saw for himself the Russian ships offloading AK-47s in Mozambique and food from Mozambique going onto the ships back to Russia. That's what was going on there. So our bad guys were being armed by Russia at the time. There's economic warfare going on. So we can destabilize the country. The State Department and so the Soviets put sanctions on South Africa. The idea was to get as many people out of work as possible, and those people become cannon fodder. They're very easy to manipulate and use, and they get drawn into this revolution. Now, communists are really interesting. They cause revolution when everybody's living peacefully. In their belief system, their whole philosophy is that they need a revolution, they need violence to be able to bring in their new world. And so even although you're peacefully, happily living in South Africa, they'll come along and cause a war when there isn't a war. And so now that they've taken over the country, we have about 22,000 murders a year. But even during apartheid, we had about 20,000 murders in 10 years. Now we have that in 1 year in South Africa. So you've got this perpetual war, civil war, chaos, murders, killing going on all the time. We had the psychological warfare that was going on. This was there to break down the will of the South African people to resist the revolution, forcing them to give in to international pressure. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on that one right now. The internal revolution was backed also by the Russians again. This was done to destabilize the country, make it ungovernable. And we were sitting in a church service in Cape Town, 25th of July, 1993. When terrorists burst in with their firearms, automatic assault rifles, so they had hand grenades and put nails into the outside of the grenades to get more shrapnel. They lobbed the grenade into the congregation and they opened up fire with their rifles. They murdered 11 people and they injured over 50. And while this was part of the internal revolution to overthrow the government, it's really interesting, this was psychological warfare. And the leader, Letlapa Bekhlele, when he was asked why they did the St. James Massacre, why they attacked the church and murdered 11 people and injuring over 50, when everybody was already at the negotiation table, his answer was, this was a terrorist attack in the true sense of what terrorism is all about. We did it to instill fear in the whites in South Africa. And so that is part of the psychological warfare. Four people control the psyche of 50 million people through a terrorist attack. And that's the way it works. We want to scare the living daylights out of all the whites so that they'll put pressure on their negotiators to take whatever the communists offer them and keep quiet and not fight. That's the way they work. So that's part of the internal revolution. Then negotiating surrender, turning over the power to the ANC and the Communist Party Alliance, that's what they were pushing for, and they worked very well for that. U.S. author John McElveny says this: the U.S. State Department helped to overthrow Chiang Kai-shek in favor of Mao Zedong in China in 49, Batista in favor of Castro in Cuba in 58, Somoza in favor of the Chavistas in Nicaragua in 79, the Shah of Iran in favor of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran in 79, and Ferdinand Marcos in favor of Corazon Aquino in the Philippines in 86. always backing the communists. Never the good guys. In South Africa, the fight, the war, the killings, the murders, wasn't between white and black. It was black on black. The peaceful, God-honoring, patriotic black people, Zulu people, the leader, Dr. Mangosuthu Buthelezi, 8 million of them, completely left aside and ostracized by the State Department and by the United Nations, and they backed a small little group, the African National Congress, that was falling to pieces and nobody cared two hoots about them. They were small and insignificant in South Africa. And then the money would just be pouring in to help them to such an extent that they could win an election. If I remember correctly, the same guys that helped the previous president coming to power here in America was brought over there by the State Department to help the Communist African National Congress come to power. So that's what we're dealing with. They also wrote the script for the revolutionaries as they took over the National Party. It was a well-known story that the leaders of the negotiation parties, the two main leaders, would go off to the American embassy to get their script for the next lot of things that were going to be happening in South Africa. It was a well-known story over there. The population become demoralized. They realize they're on the losing side. So either they vanish, they disappear, they keep quiet, or they've got to join the winners. So those are the decisions they need to make. Because if they don't, you can have a necklace put around your neck, which was a rubber tire from a car, gasoline poured over it and over you, gas, petrol, and you get set alight like a human torch. The rubber burns into your body, very, very painful death. The challenge is that it's not just the painful death that's the issue, is that the black people believe that if they die in a fire like that, their spirit doesn't exist anymore. And so they can't become part of the next life where they'll be worshipped as ancestors by those who are still living. So this isn't just any old type of murder. This has spiritual implications for the people that were going to be murdered. They got to a stage, Winnie Mandela was very good at this. Shia people have her soccer club with necklace people. She was known for it. And it got to a stage where the soccer club and others would walk around the squatter camps calling people to come for demonstration, and they'd take a matchbox with them and just walk along and shake the matchbox and say, everybody, you're coming with us. We're going to go do a demonstration now against the white government. And everybody knew what the matches meant. If you don't come, you might get a necklace or your family member. So, that's the way it was done in South Africa. People being burnt alive. The revolution followed the same pattern as Russia, China, Cuba, and Rhodesia. Same story. Mass media is used to soften the world opinion. Our former president, before the one we have now, was flown over to America. One of the Kennedy sisters introduced him to the top New York newspaper editors. They became friends and they got the ball rolling to start softening up the world for the takeover in South Africa. The government shown as evil, repressive, and very, very bad and terrible, and then everything starts crumbling from there. The religious leaders, the left wing, they love their credibility. They like the shine of being the heroes, and so they hit the press, and they are shown off to be the helpers of the revolution, and they get drawn into it, and then they start leading the masses against the government too. The ANC, now after the revolution, have said that they couldn't have done it without the infiltration of the church, because we were such a Christian society. In South Africa, even now, people in South Africa claim up to 70% of the people claim to be Christian. Now, we're not talking about people who have a living faith in Christ, but that they would associate themselves with Christianity rather than any other religion. And so it's very interesting that they would do this to get the religious leaders to help with the revolution. That's what they did. So they financed them, they gave them lots of credibility, they put them on television, they in the newspapers, make them feel special, and these liberal people will quickly forget their standing with Scripture, and they would take on what was called liberation theology, which you might have heard of in South America too. The idea there is that if Jesus Christ was around today, he would have had an AK-47 and he would have been fighting for a just political system. That's just a quick overview. Thirdly, the more the target government liberalized conditions in the country, the more the revolutionaries used those changes as a sign of weakness. And that's the way the communists work. That's the way the infiltrators work. They demand something, they demand something. When they get it, they move the goalposts. And they see you as being weak. And then they just escalate the demands. That's how they operate. Of course, the revolutionaries used bereavement tactics to create mass demonstrations of violence. So when there were funerals, they'd whip up the crowds and chaos would ensue. Burning of cars, necklacing, smashing buildings, whatever, against the government. So here we have another Communist Party cadre, the white man with Nelson Mandela. And they're singing together about Inkonto Esizwe, which is the spear of the nation, the military wing of the African National Congress. And here they're pledging themselves to kill all the whites in South Africa, with Nelson Mandela singing this at the funeral. You can pick that up, proper footage with the real singing happening on YouTube. Fifth, the youth were drawn in, incited to violence. They armed the youth. So all those guns that were coming in through Mozambique were smuggled into South Africa, arms caches were set up, and they armed the youth so that the youth will call the shots and tell their parents what to do. And in an area close to us in Cape Town, the parents took up arms against the kids. And there were shootouts between parents and kids. Because the parents said, we're not putting up with this rubbish. And so that's the kind of violence we had in the areas around us. I was in a gun debate on television once. There was an elderly black man that was debating against me. And I said to him, you people, you blacks, used to set the example and the standard in families in South Africa for our children. Your children were disciplined, they honored the elderly, they respected the elderly. I said, what went wrong? And he said to me, I don't want to criticize the revolution. He said, but they armed our children. And that was the end of that. Because they were then telling the parents what to do. Six, the trained revolutionaries began to pull out prepositioned arms and explosives. They attacked the police stations, government installations, power stations, and anybody that was a moderate, a black moderate, they'd murder them too. And sometimes take parts of their bodies and put it on fences to show everybody what would happen to them if they didn't obey the liberal leaders, leaving the country to be completely ungovernable. Seventh, the revolutionaries incited school boycott strikes, general strikes to paralyze the country. People like Archbishop Desmond Tutu was teaching liberation before education while his children were in private schools in England. And so the masses were uneducated and they just became cannon fodder. The US government appeared on the scene. They withdrew all support from the worn-out South African government and they forced them out of power and they ushered in this bunch of hoodlum terrorists that nobody cared about in the first place, completely ignoring the conservative black groups in South Africa. We kept hearing stories like communism is dead, we don't have to worry about it, the Cold War is over, the Soviet Union and its Communist Party and the KGB are history, you have nothing to fear, everything's fine. Due to these attacks, we went into economic depression in South Africa. We had the biggest explosion of crime and violence in our history. Total confusion, people frightened, they demoralized, they didn't know which way to turn. They used the mass media to mesmerize us. They even used subliminal advertising that they were caught out once by somebody. And so the propaganda machine was working against us in every which way. There wasn't any private radio stations, no private TV stations, very difficult to get out the truth. The greatest challenge was our liberal, confused churches and the leaders, so-called spiritual leaders in the country. Left their good, solid biblical foundations and started enjoying the liberation theology and giving over to the new world order. In fact, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, after the attack on our church, when the terrorists attacked our church, I returned fire at them and they ran away. They were aiming to murder everybody, over 1,000 people in the congregation. The very next morning in the newspaper, he was criticizing me and saying, we shouldn't use the same weapons as those evil people. So, anyway, I was actually quite honored that him and I were going to disagree on this issue. The government capitulated, they handed over to Bush and Gorbachev's New World Order, and the bad guys came into power. Some of the elements of the New World Order that they were moving towards at the time, the World Army, Central Bank, pushing for welfare state. In South Africa, I can't remember the statistics now, but it's something like 1 in 6 people are on some kind of welfare and getting some benefit from the state. There's only 1 million taxpayers in South Africa, just over 1 million. We passed the 1 million mark about 2 years ago, and there are 55 million people in the nation. So the paperwork doesn't match up. It can't carry on. China's been funding a lot of the government for quite a while. It's not going to go on forever. They can't afford it either. Abolition of private firearm ownership, that's been going on. The control of education. Education is a total mess in South Africa. The black politicians are complaining that things are worse than during apartheid for their own children. So you often don't find that the members of parliament and the cabinet ministers don't even have their children in state schools. They put them in private schools in South Africa because they've ruined everything for everybody else. But that's good enough for your children, but not theirs. So we have the powerful globalist capitalists put the Marxist government in power. It's so much easier to do business when you have a thug in power who's very powerful, because as long as he's happy, you can go in and rape the country. And so we're finding this now also with China's coming in, and in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which isn't democratic or a republic, China gave them a $2 billion loan, supposedly for clinics, for universities and for roads. Well, where do the roads go to? Well, they go to the mining areas. What do you think's been taught in the universities? Communism. The money never left China. So the $2 billion is still sitting in China, and they send off Chinese companies and workers to build all these things, to build the roads and to build the universities. There's no way in the world that Congo can pay that money back. So what do? They get mining concessions. And so the Chinese come in, they rape the country, none of the Congolese get any jobs, they get no benefit whatsoever. The company that's working in Congo from China is being paid in China, the money's never left there, and they're taking all the resources out. It's a brilliant way of doing it. And all you've got to do is keep the president very happy with some funding, and they can do what they like. Nobody else will put a stop to it. Controlling and manipulating the people. Some of the techniques that were used to promote the revolution, intimidation, they caused terror and fear on a wide scale in South Africa. The people that were causing the trouble wouldn't cooperate in the government setups that were already there in local government. They wouldn't get involved, they wouldn't stand for elections. Anybody that was a moderate, they'd murder them. They'd kill them, they'd terrorize their families, they'd burnt their houses down. There were times when the defense force, the army soldiers, had to go lie in the bushes across the road from black councillors who were working for a new dispensation but were involved in the structures that were already available. They would send them and let them sleep in the bush at night to protect the families of the people across the road. They created this big guilt complex in the clerics and the trendy politicians, the academics, the liberal leaders. If you would say a word to put against the communists, then you were guilty of absolute treason. They would make you feel terrible through their propaganda machine. And those who tried to point out the dangers of what was coming, you were defamed and made to look like an absolute idiot. They ridiculed all the patriotic citizens, of which there were many. As I was just talking about the Zulus, the Inkatha Freedom Party, 8 million blacks, completely ignored them, ridiculed them. They blamed them for everything that was going on in South Africa. They're in a certain part, they're in the eastern side of South Africa. But on the western side, where there were terrorist attacks and people being murdered left, right and center, the poor Zulus would be blamed for that too. And they don't even live there. They're nowhere near that area. They're very localized. And so this is the kind of propaganda machine that was going on. Exploited to the utmost all situations of poverty, homelessness and destitution. Every country has homeless people. Lots of them are there by choice. I've dealt with them on the streets in South Africa. They don't want to go to homes because there they've got to be disciplined. There's structure. They don't want that. They stimulated racial hatred, fear and prejudice amongst the nations. It still gets fueled today. It gets brought up all the time. Everybody's living happily together, and the politicians use rhetoric to fuel hatred and to cause trouble amongst the races. They mobilized and manipulated the workers. They supercharged the climate by just causing havoc everywhere. They speak in symbolic terms. They're always calling for freedom. Freedom in Africa is not liberty in America. Right? Freedom in Africa means that you got access to the resources of the country. And so when I've been dealing with the former terrorists in South Africa, they'll say to me, we spilt our blood to put those people into power, but they do not share their freedom with us. That is African freedom. Access to resources, access to jobs, gold, silver, all the nice things in the country. That is freedom to a communist black man. He talks your language, but he's not meaning the same thing as you. Democracy in Africa is not democracy in America. So they conquered the student minds, got them all upset, got them burning down places. They're actually burning places down their universities right now. Over $40 million worth of damage in the last few months in South Africa, which is big for us. They got their cadres and their people into all the schools, the universities, the technical schools. They took control of the teachers' organizations, the student newspapers, the youth groups. They did all this. Why can't we Christians do this? Why can't we go undercover? Why can't we get involved in all these sorts of organizations? This is what they were doing, taking full control of everything. They intimidated big business, and now they got to such a stage in South Africa where they passed laws that if you don't have a certain ratio of colored or black people working in your organization, then you get taxed at a higher rate. And so they enforce it by law, and that's the way the communists work. The agents got into the security network, they got into the police force, they got into the army everywhere. They discredited and attacked the security forces on all occasions. They were being shot up. They were petrol bombing police stations, all this sort of thing, and tried every which way to obstruct the police and the establishment. They established radical alternative media. And so they could run radio broadcasts and that from outside of South Africa into South Africa, calling for the chaos that they wanted for the revolution. And also in South Africa now, there's a good working relationship between the Muslims and the communists. The guys that attacked our church were communists in South Africa, the Azanian People's Liberation Army, but they were trained by the Muslims, Qibla, a radical Muslim organization. And so we see that still happening today, a radio station in South Africa, a Muslim station, now that there's, we can have some private radio stations, they were calling for people to come forward to be trained to go murder the Americans and kill them in Afghanistan and in Europe. The civil service, journalists, politicians, anybody that was vulnerable, they intimidated them, they blackmailed them, and tried whatever they could to get them onto their side. Morality was broken now. They're pushing a lot of pornography into the country. Homosexuality and obscenity in the media was coming through very, very fast. And to the extent that when they came to power, they legalized pornography in South Africa. The African National Congress, Mandela's group. Even child pornography, if it is used for artistic discussion. Alright, they brought in the homosexual marriages, and just they're busy right now to try and pass laws for euthanasia in South Africa. Abortion was legalized through them. Holocaust, over 1 million babies have been murdered since they legalized it. So they eliminated all laws against obscenity. Everything that was controlled, they shouted censorship, violation of freedom of speech, and they wanted all the disgusting things that they possibly could. And that's very normal for a communist takeover. They don't allow it in their own countries, back in Russia and China and these places, but they push it onto you to break down the morality and the strength of the people in the nation and their cohesion and their Christianity. Break everything down that they possibly can to make it easier for them for their revolution. So they corrupted the young, got people's minds off the reality, got them into sport, and they sent a sports team over to Australia, and they would say to us, there's a referendum now, we're going to have a vote about some political issue in South Africa. If you don't vote the way the communists want you to vote, we're sending your sports team back from Australia. So there's everybody working, all in cahoots. It's the State Department of America, it's the Australian government, it's the British, the Russians, Chinese, all working together to fight the South African government. It's quite interesting. They discredit the family as an institution, arming the little ones, the kids. They encourage promiscuity, that's never ended. It's deviant sex and divorce and things going on, homosexuality. They've made it very normal. And these are things that are against African culture. Africans don't murder their children because it's the kids are their retirement annuity. Right? They have children because they don't have, they don't put money away in retirement annuities and pension funds and that sort of thing. Their children are that. So they don't murder their children. And it's very, very foreign for them to do that. Africans are very, very against homosexuality. A friend of mine was a secretary to a cabinet minister who actually just died this last week. And he said to me, we are being forced here in South Africa to pass very un-African laws, and big money changes hands. It's been financed from outside and it's been enforced upon us. The stories, I don't know how true it is, but that Soros has been financing our gun control in South Africa. The passing of the laws and even the paying of people handing in their guns, apparently. So, they always talk about democracy, but it's not the same democracy that you are thinking about here. They maintain the pressure on all sides until people are thoroughly weary. You're at the end of your tether, you don't know which way to turn anymore. You have all these false promises, and they're attacking you, they're throwing petrol bombs into shopping centers, they're burning off the ATMs, they're shooting at people in buses and murdering people. Everybody's exhausted, they're scared, they don't know what to do, and so they put pressure on their leaders to just give up, do what the communists tell us, and let's get on with our lives if we can. They've also been talking about a second revolution in South Africa now. But the first one wasn't good enough. It wasn't communist enough. The people still have money. And so the attackers of the St. James Massacre, they told me we're preparing for the second revolution because the first one didn't go far enough. So there's been a lot of speculation about this in the press. And Letlapa and Pekhlele made this very clear. This is the director of operations who gave the go-ahead for our church massacre. He's publicly stated that they're preparing, at a university, he said that they're preparing for another revolution in South Africa. And so we've had a drunk politician from the ANC court, drunk and driving, and he made the comment, when Mandela dies, we will kill you whites like flies. Then we've got other ones. White dogs will be killed. Police officers told a farmer. Another chap on his, one of the revolutionaries on his Facebook page said that there's an army of 3,000 people ready that can be called up in 24 hours to kill the whites in South Africa. And so we can carry on. Just lately, in the last week, one of the members of parliament has now said, oh, we're not going to murder the whites in South Africa yet. In other words, the genocide will still come, but it's not going to happen right now. And so this kind of stuff that goes on all the time. Another one. No matter what the traitors say, we are marching forward to a freer Zania. Betrayal democracy is over. The revolution cannot be stopped. Atlas, stick to its mission. Atlas, the group that shot up our church. Arm the people, liberate Zania. And so these are the kind of things that is going on there, and there's just so much of it. I won't go through all that. The racial war has been statements by South African politicians saying that there will never be another racial war in our country, which they used as an excuse for the last one. They said it was because of race. But they're saying this one will be a real, true communist revolution. So it's going to be the poor overthrowing the rich. And when I spoke to one of these young cadres that's involved in preparing for this revolution, I said to him, but aren't all whites rich? Yes, they are. So it doesn't matter that they're whites living in squatter camps. I've got a little video here of whites in the squatter camp that I work in as a missionary. That's irrelevant. We're just going to wipe out all the whites. Because if you're white, you must be rich. It's just this absolute nonsense. And so this is the man, that the chap with the white top on. He's the director of operations that of the group that shot up our church. His name is Leflaf and Bechlele. So with all whites, okay, that's the one. So I have acquaintances who were terrorists. I've been reaching out with the gospel of Jesus Christ to these people. I've ministered amongst them. They call them non-statutory forces, i.e. terrorists, during the apartheid era. And they complained that, you know, we've worked so hard and we've spilled our blood. Our friends are dead to try and put these people into power. And we got nothing out of it. One chap I spoke to, he said, I was the model child. If my father ever wanted to tell anybody about how to be a good kid, he'd refer to me. I went to teacher's training college. I then left to go fight in this revolution. I've got nothing today. But the guys who stayed in college are now deputy principals of schools. And they got nothing. And so these are the guys we believe in South Africa, the ones that are going around and attacking people. They attacked me one day when I went into a pseudo squatter camp area. They held me up with a gun. We got into a shootout there again, attempted carjacking. They were looking for my firearm and for cash. And they got away with a bunch of passports with people that were visiting us. We were running a great commission course with Dr. Peter Hammond. And so this is the kind of thing that happens. And you're shooting out there. These guys are so brilliant that when that shootout happened, when they tried to steal our vehicle, they had a sentry hidden away in amongst the shacks. They were shooting back at me while I was shooting at their guys that were attacking us. And no thug that's untrained has a sentry hidden away when they do an attack. This is a military operation. And these are these guys that have got nothing today. That's what they're doing in South Africa. And I believe that they're the people that are murdering all the white farmers in South Africa too. Over 3,000 white farmers have been murdered in the last couple of years in South Africa. And it can only be these guys. Arms caches have been found around South Africa still. There was total uncooperation from the communist forces when it came to the new dispensation. They were supposed to hand over their guns. They didn't do that. They found every excuse to not be helpful with that. So they weren't cooperating at all. And even now, we still got these arms caches. Never been handed in, never been uprooted. And just a while back, 98, there was a parliamentarian from South Africa who was caught by the Mozambican police buying AK-47s in Mozambique. Why would he be doing that if they can buy from China or Russia with no problem? Very interesting. So this is all stuff that they're bringing in underhand, under the radar, so that it doesn't get into the books of government. Nobody knows what they've got. And then I spoke to a politician after I wrote a letter about this. He said, please come to my office. We have to leave our cell phones outside. We want to talk business. He said, I've heard that every week the ANC, the government, is bringing in illegal guns so that there's no paperwork. Nobody knows about it. The army doesn't have it on their records or the police. And they're bringing in weekly from Mozambique into South Africa now. So disarmament. Wanting to disarm the nation. And I spoke to an ex-unit commander in ACLA, in the Zanian People's Liberation Army. He said, we're going to take over this country. We're going to wipe the rich people out in a communist revolution. And I said to him, you can't do it if the people are armed. And he said, no, you're right. You can't. And so having an armed population is very, very close to my heart. When they started the disarmament process in South Africa, guess who headed it up? The chairman of the Communist Party. given his seat in government. And so we can see over the years in Turkey, the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, China, Uganda, Cambodia, Rwanda, over 100 million people murdered. Every time after gun control laws were passed and the people were disarmed. So you can't have a genocide with an armed population. Right? When wars take place, means that there's two lots of people with guns that are shooting at each other. Genocides, one group can't have guns because the other group then can just wipe them out completely. So you can only have a war when everybody's armed. But you have a genocide when one group is not armed. And so we have these flinging matches with words like people being called cockroaches in South Africa, which is the same word they used in Rwanda, where before they wiped out almost a million people. There with the Hutu government supporters describing the Christian Tutsis as cockroaches. We have a lot of anti-white propaganda, apparently on television. I don't watch the television stations, so I don't know, but apparently there's a lot of anti-white propaganda on it all the time, vilifying the businesses and all this sort of thing going on there. You might think this concern is completely outrageous. It will never happen. There's too much information out there today. No, it can happen. And what they normally do is they wait for some big explosion or something major to happen in another country, and that's when their people will disappear. People get killed by accidents in motor car accidents. Some people disappear altogether. Places like Zimbabwe, you don't know where they are. They're just not around anymore. Might be wise to remember Oliver Cromwell and his saying, put your trust in God, but mind to keep your powder dry. My book, Shooting Back, and the DVD are available from our website, missionaryinafrica.com. If you'd like to go through there, you can pick it up again, but there's still one DVD left. I've also got some of our newsletters for our ministry that we're doing in Central and Southern Africa. The idea there is to use projects for the gospel to get out and to be able to disciple people. And we're seeing very exciting things happening with families coming to faith in Christ. They're working hard and starting to be productive. They're taking dominion in their areas. We've got young kids that we've been ministering with for 12 years who are now community leaders in their areas at the age of 25. One kid was the head of a household at the age of 12 when we found him. He's now a community leader. He leads people in their 40s and 50s. Even the tribal chief has been part of the process to get this young man that's one of our Christian leaders in the township to speak to represent them when speaking to government. So we're seeing lots of very exciting things happening. And this young man, I've given him some good, solid Reformation writings on the internet, and he's talking about us applying Christian laws in their squatter camp. Because the police are part of the enemy, they don't trust them at all, and so we have to apply our own laws. And part of that is them acting as fathers to the young men who are getting involved in gangs. And so when these young men do it, these 20-something young guys help the mothers, and they'll spank a good spanking to these young 16 and 17-year-olds, and then they have no trouble with gangsterism or stabbings for the next 6 months to 18 months, depending on how things are happening in the township. So they're taking responsibility. They had an attack the other day where four guys came armed into the squatter camp. They attacked the shop, the local shop. The whole community, when they saw or heard what was going on, started coming towards the attackers. Three managed to get away. They caught one guy. And as they were holding him, an old man came walking along with his walking stick. And he took his stick and he beat this thief. And as he did that, everybody climbed into this thief. And immediately the police were there to do what? To protect the thief. And so these people, you mustn't talk to them about the police. They're not interested. They're sorting out their own law. And they're looking to God's law to try and make a difference in their own community and ignore all the rubbish, which they know justice isn't done otherwise. Anyway, they took the car, the getaway car of the bad guys, and they put a petrol bomb in that and sent that to smithereens. So that set a good example for anybody else that's going to come into our township. we will beat you senseless if the police aren't here to protect you, and we will burn your vehicles. So they're pretty hardcore. They're not going to allow people to come in with guns and start shooting up their people and stealing from their shops. So pretty novel the way they're working there. But strange culture, very, very different to ours. Any questions, comments?
Can you give us an example of subliminal advertising?
An example of what, sorry?
Subliminal advertising that you saw.
Oh, subliminal advertising. Yeah, I didn't see it. It was picked up by some people that did know what was happening. It's when they flash messages on your television screen or on a movie screen so fast that your eye can't pick it up, but your subconscious does. That's, I suppose, a very quick, easy way of explaining it. So it goes so quickly on the screen that your eye can't pick it up at all, but your subconscious registers what the message was. And so they would use that on our television screens in South Africa psychologically to get us to start accepting the takeover of the communists in the country. And it was extremely powerful. I mean, to the extent that my father, who is a staunch old Afrikaner, godly man, brought up in the church and everything, would become sympathetic to the Klerk and these guys who are handing over to the bad guys. They'd have be very concerned and very start getting very sympathetic towards them. That's how powerful it was. But I can't remember how, but somebody managed to pick this up, and it was happening. It became national news in South Africa. Something happened to him while he was busy with his TV, and he managed to pick up this message coming through immediately while he was watching a program. Strange. Any other comments? By the way, it was illegal in the country to do that. It was against the law at the time. So, who knows, the government breaking their own laws. Can you believe it? Who would have thought? Yes. There's a microphone coming.
So I just wonder what it's like living day to day in South Africa, because the way you described it, you're being run by communists, people are getting killed, and anybody who disagrees with the government is attacked. So, and yet it sounds like still normal life is going on. You had family there.
Yes.
So what really, can you paint a picture of what life is really like?
Yes.
It's,
okay.
On one hand, it sounds very, very bad, and how
yes.
can anybody survive? And then on the other hand, still people are going on with life, and you have a ministry.
Yes. It's really interesting, because the communists in Africa are not as philosophically astute as the communists in East Germany and in Russia and in China and those places. In other words, the communists there are also poor. The leaders are just as poor as most of the people in the country. And in Africa, it's not that way. They love the free market for themselves, but nobody else. And so they would, for instance, in Angola, there's one oil company in Angola that free markets economic principles apply to, but nobody else in the country. So they can do international business and things all the time. Why? It's run by the president's daughter, and it's to finance the government and the cronies in parliament. And so that's the way it works. In South Africa, the communists love their money. They all want to drive Mercedes-Benzes. So they let the free market run, but they just tax you to death. So they let it keep going, but it's generating funds for them. And it can't go on forever, because it's just every Tom, Dick and Harry is on the government. A government payout somewhere along the line. And so that encourages the girls to have little babies in the townships, in the squatter camps, because they get money for having a child out of wedlock. And then if the child has got alcohol fetal syndrome, they get more money. So the boyfriends will try and get them drunk and booze them up while they're pregnant, because there's more funds available once the child's born. So that's the kind of thing that's going on. The communists have taken control of every part of the government they possibly can, but not to the extent where they want things to run so that money can still come in, believe it or not. But they break you down in every which way. They're trying to control the judiciary now, which is the last bastion that hasn't been taken over by the government. And it got to a stage where whenever anybody took the government to court, they won their case. Just because the The courts were so against the government interfering in the law. But by the time we went to take the government to court, we sued them on the firearms issue. Our case was so solid. We had the deputy judge president of the Western Cape heard our case. We won our case in 15 to 20 minutes. And then the government didn't obey the law. They didn't obey the judgment. So we went back to court to get the government to obey their own judgment of the deputy judge president. And by that time, they had put in an acting judge, a political judge, and they overthrew the case that we won. Didn't go there because of that. We went there to get the government to do what they were supposed to do. But they put in a political man, they overthrew our case. That's the way. So they're starting to control the judiciary now. They got their fingers in all the newspapers, in the media, and they're controlling everything they can. And so it's a big struggle. So day to day, crime is out of control. Our petrol prices and things are all controlled by government, so it's double the petrol price that you pay here. Electricity, as the communists take over, they ruin absolutely everything. So we've had rats biting the babies in the cribs in the hospitals. The police have gone down the drain. They're part of the bad guys. People don't even report crime anymore because they don't want the police coming into their houses or having anything to do with them. Taking a lot of control on all the guns around the country, try to disarmament. There's been a lot of fighting back. People don't want to give up their guns, so that's been a big thing in South Africa. And we live in fear. People live in fear. That's the way we live. I was just having a shower here in America today, and I was just thinking, isn't that amazing? I haven't checked the doors and locked anything. I just jumped in the shower, and it was so nice. Yes, before, if I'm alone at home, I'd check everything, lock all the doors, make sure everything's fine, close the security gates before I do something alone where I can't hear the noises around me. Wake up at night, pull out your gun, go see what the noises were around the house, see what's going on. And that's the way we live all the time. We're on edge. So, thank you.
Yeah, question. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. Is the good guy population going up or down?
The good guy population, very good question. The good guy population is getting smaller and smaller at the moment.
When is it going to fail?
When's it going to fail?
As far as the side.
When's it going to collapse?
Collapse.
Yeah, got no idea. We're just keeping going. What happens in Africa is you never get total collapse. What you do is you get your rich people who are connected with government, and you get the poor. And when the collapse is there, it's the middle class that gets wiped out. Because in communist states, you always have the rich. They're the guys that are getting all the contracts from government and doing business and what have you, as usual. And then you have the poor who got nothing and they kind of survive and what have you. And then the middle class just sort of disappears. They don't exist anymore. That's when you have a collapse. I'm sorry, I can't hear.
When is the middle class in Africa going to disappear?
Oh, in South Africa, it's busy disappearing at the moment. What they've done is, we're the only country in the world that I'm aware of that has special privileges? Affirmative action, thanks. You have affirmative action for the majority and not the minority. And so they're building up a very big black middle class, but it can't be sustained because the people are being forced to bring these people into their companies and pay them high salaries. Just because that's what the law says. A friend of mine said, we took a guy as a director into our company. We only took him in for one reason. He had the personal phone number of the Minister of Finance, and he could take the call straight away. And they paid him and paid him and paid him. It was so useless, did absolutely nothing. They just eventually fired him and kicked him out of the company. So that's the kind of way things are done there in South Africa. And as that middle class of useless people that have been getting their jobs because the law forces them to get these jobs, it's eventually going to collapse.
How close is the United States to that kind of scenario?
I think you'd have to answer that one, sir. I don't know. I don't know how far the United States is in these things that are going on. Yeah.
what's your hope for the future, and what do you guys, I mean, I know generally, yeah, you're sharing the gospel. What specifically are you doing to make a difference?
Okay, good question. What are we specifically doing to make a difference? In South Africa, very close by, we're running in an area called Stonehill. We're trying to get involved in every facet of the people's existence there, so we're doing everything from soup kitchens to sorting out Christmas presents for the people, mattresses for the children. We're very involved in running sports sports days for them, getting them involved in proper competitions. Very proud of our young men. We'll take 13 of them to a wrestling competition. They'll come back with 11 or 12 medals. And then one of them will be banned because he was too rough and he was going to injure the person he was wrestling against. I mean, they're real street fighters. And so we do sports with them. We got something called Dream Girls, which is a ministry to them to help the young girls there who live in fear. If a black man wants the girl's body and he wants sex, she's got to give it to him in their society. She can't say no. It won't be considered rape and it won't be reported to the police. We've got the a ministry called Soldiers for Christ, which I run, taking the young men, getting rid of their energy, taking them to the beach and running them there. Teaching them the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, getting exercises done by them, getting them to work hard, taking them out on ministry outreaches. And so we're trying to influence a couple of thousand people through that. We do evening services, gospel evening services, Bible studies, and so we're very, very involved in the community. Right now, we're looking at taking some tiny little ones that are in a preschool and putting them onto our property. Because they're in a little tiny rundown hut that will leak. I'm talking about a little wooden and metal hut, that small little area to play. And so we're wanting to get them into a more secure environment by us. But while you're dealing with all these people, you're reaching the families, you know, you're getting to know the people, and we're impacting them in a very big way like that. In Zimbabwe, we're doing businesses there. We're setting up a mill now where people bring their maize to be milled. And so they pay for that. And then we help the widows and orphans with the funds that are coming in. We're doing the same in Zambia at the moment. And so every area, depending on what's going on in that area, we try and help in different ways. But the bottom line is for the gospel to go out, which we believe incorporates God's law and his word being applied in every day and in every area of their lives. And so that's what we're trying to do through the projects, is to be able to have access to teach them how to live with us and get them involved in you know, the political structures and that sort of thing, which is a long, very slow process.
This is the first time I heard specifically that the blacks were going to kill the whites in South Africa. Why hasn't that news gotten to America?
Good question. The press in South Africa also suppress the information. Now and again they come up with a little bit of information on this, but now in the last week, surprisingly enough, it's become a big issue in South Africa where nothing gone now. As I left the country to come here, it's just started to hit the headlines in South Africa. So it can easily be found on the internet. But why, you know, it's the same story. They wait for something big to happen here. The whole world's focus is on America and what's going on with the elections here, and that's when they'll cause trouble over there. They're not going to do it when the whole world's focusing on them. So they're threatening us, and they, you know. And there again, it might just be intimidation, but I've heard this from people that have been terrorists who are preparing for this now. The guy that shot up our church. I've got to know them. I've had breakfast with them. We've spoken about all the things you shouldn't speak about, like religion and politics. And I've got to know them, and they're very open about this. And I've spoken to other black friends of mine, and they say, yes, these things get discussed in the taxis when we're driving to work in the morning. They discuss these issues. And they're calling for meetings in the squatter camps and that to discuss these issues. Yeah. Yeah, the blacks killing the whites. Yeah. So, and also it's just politically incorrect to speak about it, because you're a minority group, and so, you know, you get blamed for everything. So if there's trouble in the country, it's actually just got to a stage now where it's become a joke, where if anything goes wrong, it gets blamed on apartheid and the whites. This is ridiculous. You know, they took over 1990. So, and it's really, at the end of the day, isn't it a black-white thing? There are blacks and whites on all sides, conservative, liberals, there are blacks and whites on every side. It's just the majority, you know, that's the issue. So, both biggest parties in parliament are led by blacks. And so the blacks voting for both lots, you know. It's not really a black and a white thing. It's just a matter of the way they manipulate things and the way they try and pull the shots and intimidate and that sort of thing. They've chosen to go for a minority group. The same happened in Zimbabwe, except that they pushed the whites off the farms, took over the farming, because they blamed them for all the problems in the country. So 200 white farmers left Zimbabwe and went to Zambia, and they turned the whole economy around in 2 years from a net importer, a net importer of food to become net exporter of food in 2 years. And they are making, they're still exporting from Zambia since the 200 farmers went up there. But in the same story, Robert Mugabe went and wiped out 20 to 30,000 black people in a minority tribe in the western side of his country. So, there again, it's not a black and white thing. It's an issue of philosophy, it's an issue of communism, it's an issue of Christianity versus the communists in these various areas. But my time's up. Thank you very much for having me. It's been wonderful. I'll hang around. I'll hang around if anybody wants to chat to me more. And thank you very much. It's been great chatting to you. Thank you very much.